Auch gar nicht zusammen. Yes. So, good morning, Professor Mesa. Thank you very much for sitting down with us. As we discussed ahead of this interview, the theme of this discussion series is the history of Rapid Asymmetry Breaking in Physics, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. But before we dive into that topic, I'd like to ask you a few questions about this. So I want to ask you a few questions on background. First, can you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before starting university?
Oh, I grew up in a small town in the center of France called Aurillac. And I did all my studies there until the baccalaureate. And then I moved to Paris in a preparatory school for this typical French system, preparatory school for Grandes Écoles. And I arrived in Paris in 74, and I entered École Normale as a student in 76.
And what drew you to science? What was your exposure to science at that point?
I was attracted. Well, I had only a tough choice to make, which was after the baccalaureate, which is really the moment in which you decide what is the orientation for your superior studies. And attracted both to philosophy and to science. And at some point, the French system drew me to the system of Grandes Écoles, which was predominantly open, easier for me in some sense to go to science.
And how did you get interested in physics then, more particularly?
Well, I got interested in physics very soon. I was already interested in physics at high school. I had a wonderful teacher there. And I had also an excellent teacher of physics in the preparatory school, so in class préparatoire. And so already during the class préparatoire, I was interested probably more to physics than to mathematics, even if I was in the mathematics section and I prepared the entrance exam of École Normale in mathematics. But I was very, very fond of physics already at that time.
And then what led you to pursue in Thèse de Troisième Cycle with Claude Bouchia in particular?
Oh, there was
in high energy physics.
The system at that time, so that was what was called the DEA. DEA meant like the equivalent of the second year of master. That was, it was a decisive moment because in some sense there was a ranking at the end of this year, and the best students would go typically either to École Normale or to the Saclay theory group, and I was in that choice, and I was hesitating, and so I decided to join École Normale because it was the best lab of theoretical physics, and the tradition was really to do the Thèse de Troisième Cycle with a lot of field theory and also with some contact with phenomenology. So that is what I did, and that's why I joined the group.
So, sorry, with Bouchia in particular, or was there a choice of advisor? Or
well, there was not much choice of advisor. It was nature. Bouchia at that time was the person who would really coach, let's say, or train the young students arriving at École Normale in the lab.
So maybe can you elaborate a little bit on this, because you said that there was this choice between Saclay and École Normale. I think we have an idea of the group in Saclay because we had previous people who described it. I think we don't have a clear idea of the group, of the theoretical group at École Normale at the time. So what were the options? How was the group organized?
The group at École Normale was very largely particle physics. The leaders of the group were probably Claude Bouchia, my advisor, Philippe Meyer, who was my co-advisor with Bouchia for the Thèse de Troisième Cycle, not for the Thèse d'État, but and John Iliopoulos, were really the leaders of the group, and there was a strong topic in the group which was also around supersymmetry with Pierre Fayet, supergravity with Cherk, Kremer, Jean Gervais,
So to some extent, supersymmetry and supergravity had been founded in that lab. So they were the leading directions, let's say. But the tradition would be that at the level of the thèse de troisième cycle, which was a very short thesis in some sense, one would start by first learning about field theory that was not taught at the moment in classes. So I remember that my first contact with Bouchia, he got a pile of papers on his table. It was probably high of 30 centimeters. And this was the course of Itzigson and Zuber, which was not yet published as a book. And he told me, you read this and you come back to see me.
Okay.
And I don't remember, I think after 3 weeks I came back and I told him, look, I have not understood everything, but I, and he started to challenge me, because Claude was a very kind but very tough advisor at the same time.
So there was no statistical physics group at
the
time?
No, the only one who was doing statistical physics was Nicolas Sorlas.
Okay, he was there.
He was there. Sorlas was there, but he was quite marginal in some sense in the group.
Okay.
There were also Julia. I said Fayet. Yes. Well,
and Toulouse was not there.
Toulouse was not in our lab at that moment. He was in the other lab.
Okay.
He was in the lab of how was it called? Laboratoire de matière condensée.
But still at École Normale.
Yes.
Okay.
And so was Jean Vanimenu, or?
Jean Vanimenu also, yes.
Okay.
So students who wanted to do statistical physics had an option at École Normale in that other lab?
Yes, yes. Really, in the lab of theoretical physics where I entered, there was not an option to start with statistical physics itself, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the only way was to start with field theory and then maybe move later on, but
mm-hmm.
It was, you have to consider that the impact, I mean, all these groups was very much influenced by their history of the previous 2 or 3 decades. They had created the lab moving from Orsay to École Normale. I think it was created, one should check, but it was created 10 years before I joined or something like that. And at that moment there had been some bitter separation between various people doing theory. And there were the people, field theorists, let's say, on one hand, and others which were more some other type of phenomenology, etc., which was not the same. And so for them, in some sense, for the group that settled in École Normale, field theory was really the building block. It was a thing that was very important. And it was understood that any respectable theorist should be a field theorist, first of all. So that's what I learned.
But still, the statistical field theory part was not... it was developed in Saclay, if we understand, and where it's
well,
possible.
we had of course in the master in the DEA there were lectures of statistical
okay.
physics. Edouard Brezin was teaching. He was my
okay.
teacher. He was, as you can imagine, he was giving beautiful lectures. So I had been exposed to Ising model, to phase transitions, etc., etc.
Okay.
But it was not, at least in our lab, it was not considered as a discipline in itself. It was a branch of theoretical
mm-hmm.
physics, but that you could do after having done your classes in the mainstream.
Okay.
It's
so,
only later, well, that's a bit of a different topic, but it's only, it took quite some time in order to have possibility to have students joining this lab and doing condensed matter or statistical physics.
At that point, you were working, I think, on perturbative QCD, is that correct?
Yes.
So what were the problems that you were specifically pursuing?
Oh, during the thèse de troisième cycle, I did really some work on perturbative QCD, on deep inelastic diffusion and neutrinos. So it was computing cross sections for some specific type of observables. It was a kind of exercise. Unfortunately, the experiments could not be done at that time. They were done much later than that. So it was a bit
slightly frustrating for a young student theorist like me to work on something on which the experiment will not come soon. So that was one thing. And then when I moved on from the thèse de problématique to thèse d'état, Claude Bouchiat had done some very important work with his wife actually on parity violations, the measurement of parity violations in atomic physics. And so that was very complementary to the big experiments on parity violations, because it was on a different scale of energy, so it was some very important results actually. And he told me, well, let us work on the violation of parity in solid state physics to see what could be done. And so we started to see if there would be effects that might be measurable about parity violation in solid state physics. And that was the beginning of my thèse d'état. And I must say that after 1 year or something, 1 year of working on this topic, at some point I heard some talks about some topics of statistical physics, and I went to Claude and I told him that I wanted to stop because I thought that it would not work. I mean, the order of magnitude, I mean, you have an order of magnitude which is 10 to the minus 12, and typically most experiments in condensed matter physics do not reach this level of precision. Let's say we know rare exceptions now with quantum Hall effects or something like that, but so it seemed to me that it would be very, very difficult to find an experimental situation that would allow to measure parity violation. And so I went to see Claude and I told him that I wanted to switch to statistical physics. And he had a wonderful reaction. He told me, I understand you, I think you're right, and go ahead. I am not an expert in statistical physics, but I'm ready to still be your advisor for your thèse d'état. And so you will come and report to me every, I don't remember, second week or something about the progress, and we'll discuss. And that's what we did. So it was Claude was a very open mind, and he was also of that school of theorists of that age, of that generation of theorists for whom theoretical physics was a whole. I mean, he had been working on theoretical physics applied to atomic physics, he had been working on weak interactions, and why not on statistical physics. I mean, there was no problem for him to encompass the full range of statistical physics.
You mentioned talks that you had been to that exposed you to statistical physics. Do you remember any specifics of who would have been?
Well, I remember earlier than that choice, I remember a talk that was given at École Normale by Ken Wilson, and that was illuminating. That was something for me. In some sense, I had been working with a renormalization group, you know, as it was used in particle physics, let's say, with a Callan-Simancyk, etc., etc. And I knew all that, but in some sense, my impression listening to Ken Wilson was that I started getting an intuition about what it is. It was becoming something beyond a mathematical instrument, very powerful, that I already knew, but it became something that I could feel in some sense. And that is what I, so that was one talk. It was earlier than that choice, but that was important. And I had heard Giorgio talk, but not on the topics that we'll discuss today. But at that time there were some interesting papers about about large N matrix models. And so it was called the Egushi-Kawai reduction, and that was a very nice talk by Giorgio about that, and I liked his approach. So it was field theory, but it was field theory with a StatMech tendency that I liked a lot.
In your thèse d'état, you acknowledge Surlas as having you're explicitly amené à travailler sur les sujets abordés in your thesis. How did that communication take place, or what can you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, when I decided to switch topic and move to topics of statistical physics, I discussed with Nicolas, obviously, Nicolas Fourlas, because he was the person in the lab who was doing that. And he had some suggestions, which probably we did not pursue, really did not work, but I mean, certainly he was one of the persons to whom I would talk regularly. But the thing that happened that was a major event at that moment for me was that, so when was it? It was summer 1983, or maybe early September or something like that. I had decided in the spring of 1983 to switch towards statistical physics. And then arrived Miguel Virasoro. He was on sabbatical. He arrived in Paris that summer, I think in September, I don't remember the month. And Miguel arrived and he said, well, I want to spend my sabbatical to study what are the hot topics in statistical physics, let's say. And he was, of course, extremely famous, well known. He came with the aura of his algebra. I mean, in a lab like ours, where you had supersymmetry, supergravity, Virasoro was a big name. And he came with this idea, and I don't know who told him, well, there is this young student there in the end of the corridor who is just starting to work on statistical physics. And at some point he told me, well, let's discuss together regularly, let's see if we can study things together. And I said, yes, why not? And this is how the things started, really. And at that moment there was one big, an important encounter in the corridor or around the coffee, I don't remember exactly, but it was one of these random encounters that we met with Gérard Toulouse. And Gérard told us, so I was with Miguel, and Gérard told us, well, I know that you want to, well, we told him, we said we want to go to topics of statistical physics, what do you think? And he said, oh, yes, yes. One thing that you should do is try to read this paper by Giorgio Parisi because nobody understands it, but it looks interesting. That's something for you. And that's what we did. So that was a very good a very good recommendation.
So did you know anything about spin glasses before reading that paper? Or
no.
Okay, so this was your first encounter with it.
Yes, and then of course we went to the library to see what was available,
So the paper in question is the paper is the one where
as I said when I had last month I was presenting that paper in the series of lectures in Rome about the historical paper of Parisi. And I said it's not one paper, it's actually a series of four papers. There is one in Physica, in Physics Letter, there is two or three in JPhysA, and there is one in PhysRev Letters. Let's say that's a collection of papers in which she does the one-step replica symmetry breaking and then the full, the continuous replica symmetry breaking.
So that's what Toulouse was
yes.
Pointing you at?
Yes, he was mentioning that it looked interesting. I think the community of condensed matter physicists who had been looking at spin glasses, which was his case, of course, he had this idea of frustration, etc. They had read this paper of Parisi. They did not understand what it was about, but they saw the result and they said, well, there might be something there. There's something interesting.
Do you know where Gérard Toulouse's interest in topic himself itself came from? How did Gérard get interested in this topic to begin with?
This I don't know.
Okay.
You have to ask him.
In practice, how did you learn Parisi's RSB method? Was this a study group? Was this on your own? Was this...
No, we learned it by reading the paper and redoing the computation.
So you and Miguel together?
Yes.
Or?
Well, yes. We would meet very regularly. I don't remember what was the frequency, but we met probably every day or every second day, and we were discussing what we had read. And, yes. It was not... I don't remember it as being difficult. It was strange, but not difficult.
So in 1983, Toulouse would still consider that the papers of George were not very much understandable. I mean, even as a mathematical statement.
Yes.
Okay, I thought that what was missing at the time was the physical interpretation of RSB, but at least as a mathematical construction in 83, it would have been digested or somehow
not
accepted.
not at all. I mean, the whole mathematical construction was very strange. There were the papers, there were the works of there were people discussing the interchange of the limits between number of replicas going to zero and thermodynamic limit. There was a lot of discussion, and I mean, it was not at all accepted as a mathematical method, let's say. Probably is not yet now, it is not even accepted, but it's not a standard mathematical method, but it's a well-defined thing, and we know what it encodes, we know the physics that it encodes. And the thing that was very important for us actually was, I mean, the paper that probably was even more influential rather than the series of papers on RSB, we arrived on the subject together with Miguel right at the moment, so I don't remember the month in which it appeared, but there was a paper by Giorgio, the one that appeared in PRL, is it 83 or 84, which is the paper in which he says, well, the interpretation of the order parameter function, it's the overlap between states, between pure mm-hmm. states. And that was a very illuminating paper. And that is really starting with that we started to work with Miguel, because that was the thing that gave a clue to what could be encoded in the Parisian. That
you quickly got to collaborate beyond just with Miguel. You worked with Nicolas Hurlas, with Gérard Toulouse, as well as Giorgio Parisi on this series of papers that were to come. Can you tell us how this collaboration came about and how it was? Was it really the two of you, Miguel, working together and adding
yes,
more?
Yes, well, mostly, I mean, during this fall of 1983, I was with Miguel and we were working together. Then Miguel, because we had started to work on Giorgio's papers, and Miguel had just joined Rome as a professor. And so he told me, well, I will call Giorgio. And so he called Giorgio, he told him that we were interested in these things. And so we started to interact, even not very frequently. There was no Zoom or whatever at that time, and no mail. So, but by phone, Miguel would call Giorgio from time to time, and we started to discuss at distance with Giorgio. And in particular, at some point, very soon, we were reading the papers, etc. Miguel came to me and said, well, I had Giorgio on the phone. He says that there is something strange that happens when you take three points. It seems that two of them are always close. And so then we started to do the computation of the probability of three overlaps. And then there was this property of ultrametricity. We didn't know the name. It was Ramal, who was in the other group, in the group of condensed matter, who told us, oh, but what we are describing is well known in math. It is an ultrametric. And then we went to start to decipher the fact that this property of the triangles, it meant that the states could be seen as the leaves of a tree. And then at that time we had developed with Miguel and sometime with Giorgio on the phone, but we had developed the full technology of how to ask questions about the physical space, let's say, the weights and the weights of the states and the distances between the states, so the P alpha and the Q alpha beta, let's say. How to ask questions there, go to the replica space to answer this question. So we had also another big surprise that came and that we saw with Miguel at that time was the fluctuations of the weight, the fluctuation of the P of Q. That was also another point that came. So it was really like that it was organized.
And how did Toulouse and Surlas then come to join these discussions?
Toulouse and Surlas had been more or less they had been they had had an important influence at the beginning to tell us this is an important subject. That was their main, let's say, that was one important contribution, of course.
I see. I thought that Toulouse had also been thinking about ultrametricity, but you said it's mostly Ramal that knew about this and told you this connection.
The name ultrametricity, well, it did not take us much, very long. I mean, it was surprising. The property of the triangle was surprising, let's say. How can you have a space which is organized this way? And it was very puzzling. But I mean, in order to map that to a tree and the branches, etc., that did not take much time. It was kind of a natural, in some sense. So, because you start to group the things in cluster at a certain distance, and you realize the clusters do not overlap, and so you have this structure that ramifies. So that was clear. We had, in some sense, we had all the properties that were needed, but we did not have the name, and the name was Ramal.
In the fall of 83, another visitor to ENS was David Gross, with whom you also start to collaborate at that point. Can you tell us how that came about?
Oh, it was a wonderful encounter also. I mean, I was lucky in 1983 to meet Virazoro, who told me, let's work together. And just a few months after. So the encounter with David Gross was... it was in Saclay, so we had done the work on the ultrametricity and the fluctuations on the weight, and I gave a talk in Saclay in the theory group, and in the back of the room there was a guy who was asking a lot of questions during the talk, and he comes to see me at the end of the talk, and he tells me, well, I'm David Gross. I was impressed. I knew the name, of course, because I had been studying high energy physics. So Gross, I knew his work, and he tells me, that's very interesting what you have done, etc. I'm spending now my first part of my sabbatical in Saclay, and the second part of my sabbatical I will spend in École Normale. So let us discuss this further when I come to École Normale and see what can be done, let's say. So that's how we started to discuss, let's say. It was so, because of this talk and his reaction, he had an instantaneous reaction that said, oh, that's beautiful, I want to know more about it. And then we started to work together.
So he was not involved in the group discussions with Miguel and Solas?
No.
That was not?
No. It is just that when he joined École Normale for the second part of his sabbatical, we started to work together very intensely. I mean, we had, I don't remember if maybe Miguel had gone back to Rome at that time, quite possible. In any case, we were discussing with David a lot, and there was this idea of studying the random energy model. Mm-hmm. And basically, the big surprise that we had at that time was that, so we used the tools of Parisi solution and the Q of X, etc. But to discover that the transition in the large P limit of the P spin, let's say, which maps to the random energy model, was discontinuous. There was no instability. There was no instability. There was no Almeida Thouless line. So it was a discontinuous transition. And so realizing that it was a transition that was kind of first order in some sense, in the sense of the discontinuity, but continuous from the point of view of thermodynamics. Only a function order parameter could have these properties. So that was the big thing, I think, that we realized at that moment.
Did you plan to keep on working with him after he left ENS? Or, I mean, was this the start of a larger program of collaboration?
Well,
in your mind?
I don't know, you have to see with him, but when he left École Normale, he went to Israel. He was part of his sabbatical, was also in Israel. Mm-hmm. And then he worked, he used the same kind of tools, let's say, that we had for the P-spin. He used it for the POTS model with large Q, together with whom was it? With Chaim, I think, Chaim Sampolinsky, and some other guy, maybe.
Ido Cantor.
Ido Cantor, yes, of course. And so he did that, but then he soon got back to his main topics. I think that for him it had been one year of excursion towards looking at other topics, but string theory caught him back.
So okay, so you didn't personally have a program of other things you wanted to do with him after he left. That was just one point collaboration.
It was a collaboration, but then everyone has his own topic that he wants to pursue.
What was the immediate reaction to these two series of works, the one with Miguel, the one with David Groves?
Well, I think that the work on ultrametricity and the PFQ and the fluctuation, it was my impression is that it attracted a lot of attention of the colleagues. Let's say in the talks, in the seminars, the people would ask a lot of questions. The people were curious. Gave the impression that one started to understand new things, physical things, let's say, about the spindles, and that. So yes, I think it was well perceived, and so there was quite some excitation.
I mean, did you get invited to give talks in particular venues to, or?
I think the organization of science was not exactly the same as now. So things would take a little bit of time. Gradually I would be invited to give quite a few talks, yes. But there were the Heidelberg Colloquium on spin glasses that were important moments in where I was invited. Yes, I was invited rather frequently
to talk about these works, and
frequently with the basis of frequency of talks that was at that time. It was a bit different from now.
And the second part, I mean, the work with Gross, so the understanding of the discontinuous transition in the random energy model and the P-spin, how was it received? I mean, did people... I mean, I understand that your motivation was to explore the space of possibilities for spin glass models, or...
No. Well, yes and no. We didn't know that it would give that. Our first motivation with David was to say, well, we have this replica method with replica symmetry breaking at a Parisi on the one hand. We have a solvable model which has been found by Derrida. Can we match the two? What can we do with these two things? And can we test this replica method, this RSB method, can we test it versus a solvable model? So that's what we wanted to do.
From the start?
Yes, okay. That's what we wanted to do with applying it to the REM. The REM was understood, let's say, there was not much. And at some point there was... for instance, computing the entropy in the condensed phase of the REM, this is a subtle thing that has to do with the statistics of the weight of the valleys. And when we did it, because it's not an extensive entropy, so it's a bit delicate actually, but it turns out that you get the same result with Derrida had done it directly with mathematical tools, and when we did it with the replicas, we found the same. That was a very strong indication that even on a subtle thing like that, like a finite contribution to the entropy, it was giving the right result.
Okay, so for you the motivation was methodological, let's say, was to understand
how
you could do replicas without replicas or
no, it was not a, it was to understand whether, I mean, could we test this RSB approach in a case in which everything was understood, let's say, it had to be tested. It was not, I mean, there was still enough mystery. Even if we started to understand what it could encode with the tree of states of ultrametricity, we understood what it could encode, but it was not, that did not mean that it was exact, that it was right. So we had, with the REM, we had one solvable model in which we could test it, and it worked. And, en passant, it showed very strange phenomenon, which is a mixture of a first order and a second order transition.
And so what was your reaction to that and the reaction of the community to that, to this new phenomenon? I mean, did someone, I don't know, consider it as important in some way, or was it just considered
a curiosity
or some exotic thing that...
No, I think it was considered as a, yes, it was a kind of a landmark of something, let's say. It was a... No, I think it was very well received. There was no... In retrospect, seeing it from now, it seems to me that it is... Well, we all know that there were quite a lot of, there were a few elements in favor of Parisi's solution, the fact that it had cured the problem of the negative entropy, that it had, we could interpret the two, zero field cool and field cool magnetization, there were things like that. But that was, let's say, from the point of view of theoretical physics and math, that was a solid anchor to say, well, you see, it is a method. It is strange, yes, you have to go to this number of replicas, which is zero, and there is a negative thing, etc., etc. But if you apply it to this model that you can solve with all the standard tools of mathematics, you get the right result with a Q of X function that is one step.
Maybe just to finish on this, because I think there is some link that we are a bit missing between what you did in 84, 85 on the P-spin, and then Gross did later on the POTS, and then how this arrived somehow to Kirkpatrick, Tiromalai, and Vorenes two, three years later. And it's not clear, I think, to us how in the community these ideas evolved and reached. I mean, when we asked the question to Tirumalai, it was not... he didn't really recall how your result basically arrived to them.
I don't know.
Do you have any idea of how this was...
I don't know at all. Mm. Well, it was a moment where... I mean, there was no web, there was no mail, there was no Zoom. So people read the papers, let's say. And maybe David, when he got back to the US, gave some talk on that. I don't know. Or people read it in the papers. I have no idea.
Okay.
So Bernard Derrida and Elizabeth Gardner were also working on RSV-related ideas at that same time. Were you in touch with them, and did you discuss that work at the time you were doing, or soon at the time of preprint?
Did I discuss which work? The work on
the work on the REM, for instance, on the P-spin.
I don't remember it particularly, but I am sure that I must have discussed it with Bernard at some point. I must have told him that is what we find, because Bernard was there. He was at that time. He was still in Saclay, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I'm pretty sure that we must have met at some point, and I told him. But I don't remember it, let's say, but it must have been.
But you don't remember his reaction to the news, for instance? Or?
I think Bernard was interested by what we were doing, by this. Bernard was interested by all that, certainly. Certainly, he told me several times. But he had his own way of doing things. But he understood that this was an interesting way.
You also worked on the statistical mechanics of optimization in collaboration with Jean-Vernier Menus, also roughly the same time. How did this other topic and this other collaboration come about?
Oh, that was... So, in fact, this is... with Jean-Vernier Menus, we started working just before the summer of 1984. And there had been the paper by Kirkpatrick, Gelat and Vecchi, the paper on simulated annealing, that had appeared in 1983, I think. And it is because of the Kirkpatrick, Gelat, Vecchi paper that we started to think about the traveling salesman. And we understood that this was an instance of a disordered system that could be interesting for us, and that certainly if the numerical tools could be applied to it, maybe one could also apply analytical method. And we started to work a little bit on that with Jean. And I remember the date because summer 1984 is when I moved to Rome as a postdoc. I went to Rome from summer 84 to summer 86, and then so 2 years as a postdoc, and then came back to Paris and got back to Rome another 6 months. So I spent 2.5 years in Rome altogether. But I remember that very well because when I arrived in 84, in the fall of 84, I arrived to Rome and I started to discuss, of course, with Miguel, with Giorgio, etc. And I told Giorgio, oh, there is this optimization problem, that we call them that way at that time. And I told him what we had looked at with Jean. With Jean, we had done a small study, let's say it was more a study, starting to get familiar with the topic. That time, it's at that moment that I started to learn what is NP completeness. I didn't know that. So, and then Giorgio told me, oh, that's very interesting, let's work on that. And so we started to work with Giorgio on the optimization at that moment. So this is one, yes, that's a topic. I remember it because I had started it with Jean, and then I moving to Rome, we started to work on that with Giorgio.
So, but do you know, was Jean Benimenus familiar with that problem before, or where did his interest come from?
Like mine, I mean, we were curious about that. I mean, that was just curiosity. This paper of Kirkpatrick Jeladwecki, and it was clear, I don't know how many tens of thousands of citations it has now, but it was clear from the beginning that it was an interesting paper. It was a paper that was it was showing that in some sense what for us was a pure statistical physics method, which was Monte Carlo with a decreasing gradient in the temperature, was a very versatile tool that you could apply to many other systems. And they had provided, I don't know if you remember, in that paper there is a kind of proof of concept of simulated annealing in which they do a simulation of a TSP. So, and then we said, oh, what a nice problem, this traveling salesman. Well, it was just curiosity.
So it's a coffee discussion that led to the collaboration.
I don't remember who first saw the paper by Kirkpatrick Jeladwecki. This I don't remember, but
once it's casual encounters.
Once it was on our desk, it was interesting. I think, in some sense, once this paper was on our desk, it was kind of natural because I was at least very much immersed into spin glasses, and so seeing new analytical tools able to study disordered systems, statistical physics of disordered systems. Then there came this paper which was applying numerical tools to new kinds of disordered systems, so making the junction between the two was very natural.
Before we move to the work in Rome, I'd like to get an idea of what was the general setup of the statistical mechanics community in Paris. I mean, we've talked about a few people you were interacting with, but there were others, Cyrano de Dominicis, Henri Orlan, and others. But how did it function? How did communications and...
Well, there was a strong group in Saclay with, of course, Cyrano, with Orlan. There was Descloiseau, who was doing polymer physics, Itzigson. So there was a big group in Saclay. In École Normale, we had, in the theoretical physics lab, there was Solas, and in Condens Matter Lab, there was Gérard Toulouse, Jean Venimenus, let's say. So there was no structure in the sense that there was no joint seminar or journal club. At least maybe there was some in Saclay, but we did not have that at École Normale. So it was more individual choices. And in some sense our activity, it was very much respected by the colleagues in our lab. But it was still marginal with respect to the mainstream of the lab. It was, but you see, there were. It was, yes, both marginal and respected, and maybe respected also as marginal. For instance, when for my for the jury of my thèse d'état, Claude Bouchia suggested to me to ask Jeffrey Goldstone. Goldstone was visiting École Normale at that moment. He was not at all in statistical physics, but he was again one of these guys of the old school of theoretical physics, for whom, yes, that was a topic in theoretical physics, and he would study it by reading the thesis. And he was extremely positive. I had a great time discussing the thesis with him. It was really very nice. So that's an example of another guy, let's say, who was mainstream, but who was considering that this is some new development of theoretical physics, and respected it.
And the interactions with Sekle, we typically each other see every month or every 3 months, or what on what occasions would that take
place? There was no regular occasion. There would be some seminar or conferences at which we meet, but not much more than that.
So it felt very distant.
At that time, I did not go to Sekle except when I was invited for a talk or something.
Maybe since you mentioned that there were all these people who respected and supported this effort, did you also meet some resistance or, let's say, opposition from people who considered it to be, I don't know,
not worthy of theoretical physics interest?
No, then there was, not in that area. I mean, in the group of theoretical physicists that I was discussing, I think that they were immediately considering that it looked an important step, let's say. So I did not feel any reticence from their part, reluctance from their part. I think that they were quite supportive, and I felt very much at ease with all of them. No, there was the debate came with it came over the Atlantic, because it came from the probably it was a bit later. Now I don't have the dates in mind. I think it came a bit later. But when Fisher and Hughes did discuss their models of droplets, and then that was much more tensed. It was a scientific debate about, and the debate was precisely about whether. Well, initially it was whether replica symmetry breaking could make sense at all, but gradually it drifted towards, okay, maybe it makes sense, but does it apply? It does not apply to 3D spin glass, let's say. That was a debate. And that was tensed at some time.
We'll get back a bit to this. But first, you went to Rome, right?
Yes.
In 1984. What were you specifically hoping to learn or achieve in Rome? Why Rome, and why then?
Oh, Rome! You have to understand that it was an original choice at that time. I think I was probably in that whole community of theoretical physics in Paris. The typically people went as a postdoc to the US. That was a default rule. I don't think that anyone had gone to Rome before me, and so it was a very original choice from this point of view. At the same time, Giorgio Parisi and Miguel Di Razzoro were extremely respected colleagues. And so when I said, look, I would like to do postdoc with them in Rome, everybody said, oh yeah, what a good idea. So it was not, it was original because it was not done before, but people, I mean, there was nobody to tell me, no, you have to go to the US, let's say that's. But yes, and it was very original. I think that actually after I decided to go to Rome, it was created the first set of fellowships, European fellowships for postdocs within Europe. And I had one of them. I got one of these. It was not at all the Marie Curie program. And so it was very, I don't know, there were very few of them probably at that. It was very experimental, it was the first scheme, but I got this one. And what I was looking for, I don't know, I just had started for a year or something like that, this wonderful collaboration with both Miguel and Giorgio. I had gone to Rome a little bit at the beginning of 1984. We were doing with Giorgio a paper on the correlation functions of the SK model, and I had gone to work with him for 1 week or 10 days, and so I had seen him at work on a daily basis also. And for me, the choice was obvious. I was not looking for anything particular except continuing this collaboration with these two guys. So, I mean, I was. I don't know if it was being wise. It was obvious that this was the thing to do.
So they invited you? I mean, you said you decided to go to Rome before even you had a fellowship.
They invited me, yes. Miguel had organized the thing. He told me, well, we will find money, we will find the thing, etc. We found it in the end by the European Union.
Can you describe a bit how it was to work with Giorgio and Miguel, both in terms of the discussions, but also the logistics? Because I think Giorgio was at the Roma Tre at a time, and Miguel was at La Sapienza. So what...
Yes, so I would work on a daily basis. I would work with Miguel very, very frequently. We would meet nearly every day when he had some teaching to do, but every day, every second day. And we would see Giorgio quite regularly, a bit less frequently because he was in Roma 3, but he would come very often to La Sapienza. So we would meet. I don't remember the frequency, but I would say that we met with Miguel every second day and with Giorgio at least once a week, something like that.
The traveling salesman problem that you start to work with Miguel and Giorgio once you got to Rome is a problem in theoretical computer science originally, right? What was the reception of that community to your work at that point? Were they aware? Did they become, or, and if yes, how did they become aware of it?
No, they were not much aware of it. I think that the first work in that, I should make more precise one point that you said, it's really with me, with Giorgio, that I was working on optimization, let's say.
Okay.
And so with Giorgio, we had done several things. One was about the matching problem, and one was about the TSP, the traveling salesman problem. And one result that attracted the attention was our result on the random matching problem, in which we could compute, for the random link matching problem, we could compute the ground state. So we can compute the expectation value of the length of the optimal matching by square divided by 12. And so it was the result of a rather long computation, etc., with replicas. And that attracted the attention not so much of the practitioners of the thing, but of probabilists. And there was in particular Aldous, who was a famous probabilist. And he told, when he saw our things, he told it must be wrong. And he had an argument about that there is actually a simple-minded argument which is wrong, but which gives this pi squared. He knew that. And but then gradually he got to understand what we had done, and he actually proved that it was correct himself. That was him who proved it was correct. So yes, that was. I do not think there was no immediate absorption by this other community of these methods, not at all.
Or even the results,
not so much.
So you didn't go to conferences in theoretical computer science or probably to discuss these?
No.
So did you have exchanges with Aldous, mail, or was it all just he read your paper again and worked on it?
I think he read the papers, and then I read the paper when he published the proof.
So there were others who tried to similar approaches on similar problems at about the same time, maybe more, in particular Fu and Anderson. How closely were you following these advances, and what was your reaction to these other parallel efforts?
Well, that was, I think that yes, there was a so Phil Anderson with food. They
had done this paper that was mapping the scale model, let's say, to the problem of graph partitioning, as far as I remember. It's long ago, but I still remember well the paper. It was clever because it was a direct correspondence, let's say, and so I thought that it was nice. It also shows that we were not the only one in realizing that the methods from spin glasses could be used for other systems, and so how we knew about that through the papers.
Okay.
Also, Henri Orlin had a paper in 85, I think, about similar.
Yes.
So, were you in touch?
I remember
with
that.
Or was that also independent?
It was really independent.
So, the idea was appearing more or less
in
several places.
Yes.
And so, at the time, so because again, about this debate on and criticism of RSB, so you said it came later with the droplet paper. But so at least I think in the context of optimization, at that point it was less criticized. I mean, the idea that you could use replica symmetry breaking to get some statement on optimization. I think in the paper of Fu and Anderson they have a very clear statement where they say the RSB solution of the SK model is important for this kind of problems. Was it something accepted or not?
Maybe not by mathematicians, but I think that gradually it had come. I mean, with respect to what I said before about the situation in 83, I think that by that time, but we are here in 85 or something like that, the validity of Parisi solution and of replica symmetry breaking started to be accepted. Let's say there had been. Confirmation with the REM, there had been several things. Okay, it was not a mathematical statement, but at least people who were very reluctant at the beginning, they started to see, first of all, what it means, what it contains. I mean, the fact that all this work that we did in order to decipher what is the physical content of Parisi solution, I think it was important so that people can accept. Can accept that it is a very strange and subtle way of encoding a physical reality that makes sense, that you can compare, that you can kind of test with numerical simulations, etc., etc.
So is it fair to say that at the time, let's say in 86 or something like that, 85, 86, at least for the Shevin-Tonkin-Quadric model and some optimization problems, this tool was accepted as an interesting tool?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Another direction you worked on while in Rome is that you worked on forming a replica-less or a cavity solution to the SK model. Was this effort in part a response to criticism of physicists were making about replica symmetry breaking, or was it mostly driven by a formal interest in how to get to mathematical proof?
No, we really wanted to find an alternative construction. We really thought that the replicas and RSB was a beautiful tool, but there should be another way, more direct, in which we could understand, the thing. So we probably did not have in mind so much the mathematical rigor. I mean, at that time, if you had asked me, I would probably have said, well, someone will come with a mathematical framework in which RSB will become obvious in some sense. You know, a bit like what I had in mind at that time was that it would be like for distributions. You know, you have the theory of distributions and Dirac delta function or whatever, and physicists do it like that, and it's not very nice. It's a bit dirty, etc. But it works very well. And then at some point you have someone comes with a mathematical framework and you say within the framework of linear form and sufficiently regular functions it makes a lot of sense, and that is the thing. And I thought that it would be like that, that it would be just finding the right space in which it applies naturally. So at that time, I think that the way to build a mathematically solid solution of the escape model, it was not clear that it would go, that it would not go through replicants. But we wanted to have a direct solution. Yes, that's what we wanted.
Were you, I mean, there's another group in parallel that was working on formulating a direct solution on a beta lattice, which is Thouless and Chase and Jim Setna as well. Were you following this effort, and were you at all in touch with their with
not
them?
At all, not at all. We were probably not so much aware of that. I mean, not so much. No. For us, the thing that was really the idea of adding one spin and seeing what happens self-consistently was an idea very natural. I remember so many times Giorgio, when I arrived in Rome there, and with Giorgio and Miguel, I remember Giorgio on the blackboard saying, but let us add one spin here. And then, yes, we. But the thing that was missing, and that was a crucial ingredient, was a distribution of free energies. And that I really, there, the work that I had done with Gross on the REM was quite important, because at some point we realized that all the properties that we had, that were the properties of the free energies that were encoded in the weights distribution, etc., it was as if the finite fluctuations of free energies were independent and were exponentially distributed. So that was, we had, in fact, the first paper on to build the cavity method, let's say, before the paper on the cavity method, the first paper that we have with Giorgio and Miguel is about random free energies in spin glasses. And that was absolutely crucial, because the big problem that we had was, yes, you had one spin, so you have a Gaussian local field. But then you need to take into account the reshuffling of the free energies of the states. And this reshuffling, only if the free energies have an exponential distribution, it becomes stable when you add one new spin. The distribution becomes stable. And so that was a crucial point, actually. That was mixing some kind of standard central limit theorems together with the exponential distribution of the free energies, and what we understood at that time, that it was encoding all the properties of the weights like that. So it was like the Poisson Dirichlet, etc. I mean, it got some other names later on, but we understood all of that at that moment. And that was the thing that opens the gates for the cavity.
So you've mentioned a lot how well, this work right? You working with Miguel, and you describe also how you start first working with him, you both wanted to learn the same thing. Did it always feel like a collaboration, or were there mentors and students, or how was it to work with Giorgio and Miguel at that point?
I never felt like I was a student. I've always felt like it was just a collaboration. That's one of the beautiful things of theoretical physics, the social organization of theoretical physics, is that you can have a student that comes and if he has ideas, and you are in a power basis, and there is no. So, no, I think we were just a group. The social organization of science was quite different. So, at Rome, at that moment, we were the three of us. I mean, yes, there was the other group, there were other people, but you did not have the organization in one big group with the postdocs and the students. There was no structured PhD program at that time. There were no postdocs, basically, only very, very few. So it was not at all pyramidal. There was not the big group with the group leaders, and not at all. So it was just us in an office, let's say.
Were there anyone else working with the three of you, or were present with whom you'd be talking? It was really just the three of you in isolation.
Yeah, that was enough.
Sure, absolutely.
I mean, in the sense that we were happy with that. I think we were just very happy to do it this way.
And at the time, during your time in Rome, you didn't interact with other people in Rome doing statfis, like, I don't know, there were like, I don't know, Johanna Lassini, or
No, I did. Well, I would discuss with them in the corridor, tell them what I'm doing, etc. But we were quite busy this way already. You know, we were and there were quite a lot of work to be done. There are quite a few papers, and it was. I mean, maybe now one can explain all these words in a few hours on the blackboard, but there was quite a few strange things to discover. So yes, it was keeping me busy.
So throughout this time, when did the idea of writing Spinning Glass and Beyond emerge? And why do you think that was the right time to write such a book?
Well, it came more or less at the moment of the... Well, there was a cavity method on the one hand. Cavity method, there is one anecdote that is interesting, by the way, I think that... because we were very excited that we had found a way to understand the level crossing and the pure states with the cavity, etc. And so we do all the computation, we find all the results of the replicas, and so we were enthusiastic. And the week after, we arrive, and both Miguel and me, we arrive and say, oh, I have drafted the first draft of the paper. And so we had two first drafts of the paper. And what we did, which was a mistake in retrospect, is that we mixed the two drafts. And so this is probably why this paper on the cavity method is difficult to read, because it turned out that the two drafts, they were not the same. All the formulas were the same, but the way we were thinking about the thing were different. So I always take this as an example of the fact that you can do work every day nearly with someone, etc., but when it comes to writing, you will have something which is different. So, yes, yeah, so in the end, so that was just to say about the writing of the cavity method. No, but we decided to have to write the Beyond because, I think we explained it in the introduction to the book. We thought that on the one hand, there was a full set of methods that was worth describing. And there started to be at least two main fields towards where it could provide interesting applications, optimization on the one hand and neural networks. So neural networks, when was Hopfield paper, was 84 or something like that. Amit Gutfreund and Sopolinsky, I don't remember, 86, 85. Mm-hmm. And yes, so when we started to work on the book, it must have been 86, probably.
So towards the end of your time in Rome.
Yes, yes. And that was very natural. That was very natural. In some sense, yes. The thing that happened is that because we were just immersed in the cavity method, the original part of the presentation of the book was more focused on the cavity method.
And how did it take place? I mean, did you, the three of you provided equal contributions, or were you leading, convincing your colleagues to write the book, or?
No, I think we were, all of us were agreeing to write the book. I don't really remember, it was not hard to write this book because, well, first of all, it's not the part that we wrote ourselves is not that extensive. It's, I don't remember, 80 pages or something. It's not, so it was not a, it was an easygoing collaboration. I don't really remember how it was organized. I remember that it was done on the Macintosh, so that was a big revolution with respect to the previous years. And I always take this example that of course I have lost the disks on which I had written that, so I have no computer copy of my book. Except the scanned copy by pirates that put it on the web.
Upon your return to Paris, you start to work on neural networks with your first thesis students, Werner Klaut, and with Jean-Pierre Nadal.
Yes.
First, how did you recruit Werner as a student to work on this topic? And I guess as a junior independent researcher at that point. And then the collaboration with Jean-Pierre.
So Werner was a student. He was in Paris with a Studentenstiftung fellowship. So he was a very bright student, and he was looking for a PhD. And I don't remember. I proposed to him, so it went very, very easily this way. And it is true that at that time, though we are around 86, 87, the neural networks were a hot topic. Associative memory networks, and yes. So that was a natural collaboration. Jean-Pierre Nadal was very much interested in that. And so we started to work together. We have had also, we had had with Jean-Pierre Nadal and Gérard Toulouse, we were involved in a lot of discussions with people in neurobiology. It was an interesting time also from that point of view. I mean, there were contacts between us and people in neurobiology, contact with people more in psychology. So, for instance, at that time I met with Jacques Meller, who is an expert on how the children learn the languages, let's say, experiments on that. We had a developed contact with Jean-Pierre Changeux. There was the young Stanislas Dehaene, who was a student of Changeux, who were also in these groups. So that was it was a very open time, in some sense, from this point of view. I would say that there was both the development of the neural networks as we know it, seen from physics, but also it created a lot of interface with various communities. It was the beginning of what was called the cognitive science in France, and there was a lot of cognitive science programs. So I had a lot of occasions to discuss with colleagues from completely different horizons. Also people from computer science, let's say, using neural networks, like a group of the group of Dreyfus, for instance. Yes, so that was a very rich time. The thing that did not realize very well, that did not get concrete, was the collaboration with the biologists, with the changeur, etc. It did not really work. We met regularly for discussions, etc., but we could not turn it into something.
I mean, one of the...
Can I have a break to get some water?
Absolutely.
And go to the restroom because I see that my throat is in.
Okay. As we were just discussing the work on neural networks, so one of the key meetings, I think, early on was a meeting in Jerusalem about neural networks.
Yes.
Were you there?
Yes, I was there. I spent, I spent a month or 3 weeks in Jerusalem. Yes, there was this meeting organized by Amit Gutfreund and Sompolinski, as far as I remember. Yes, it was a very important meeting, very nice.
So what can you tell us, what do you remember from that meeting, or what was being discussed? Or?
Well, I think, very clearly, that part of the meeting was more about the interface of neural networks with neurobiology, let's say. So it was both theoretical physics developments and the interface to neurobiology. But I told you that there were also other interfaces that were interesting, like cognitive science, etc., mm-hmm. etc. But neurobiology was clearly the focus, it was the main interest, and it was important, yes. Well, I remember that there are two papers by Amit Gutfreund and Sompolinski. The first one, I think, is about the finite number of patterns. And then there comes the paper on the infinite number of patterns, memory, the threshold. And yes, we were immediately. I was interested by the paper, and I think that I had started on the extensive number of patterns work when I saw the first paper, but they were already on the track and they did it before. But it was clearly something that, as soon as we knew about that, it was attracting quite some attention.
I think Elizabeth Gardner also was there, and Bernard Derrida were there. Yes. So were you at the same time as you? Were you discussing?
I do not remember. I remember meeting with Elizabeth and Bernard in Paris or in Saclay.
Okay.
That is clear. Yes, yes. I don't remember discussing with them during that meeting. I discussed a lot with Daniel Amit, actually, during that workshop, yes.
There was another meeting, I think, at about the same time at the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara on a similar theme. Were you at that meeting as well, or?
I don't remember it. No, I don't think so.
Peter Young was a co-organizer, but not me. In 1990, you published on a different topic, right, about the 1 over D expansion for hypercubic lattices with Antoine Georges and Jonathan Yedidia. How did this other direction come about, and how closely were you following the finite D discussion about droplets at that point?
Well, to me, honestly, I have, from the very beginning, I have considered that, the very beginning, at least as soon as early as 1985 or something, I have thought that the main importance of what was being done, what we had done on the SK model, etc., was its interfaces. It was the beyond, the part which was the beyond. That even if it did not apply at all to the real spin glass, never mind. It was a big thing in itself. So that's why I jumped in all the directions that were the beyond direction. Let's say the optimization, the biology, etc., etc. That to me was the most interesting part of it. Of course, simultaneously, I was always interested in seeing what happens in 3D. But for the 3D problem, well, there was of course the droplet model, and became clear rather soon that the final world, if there would be a final world, it could come from simulations, not much more than that. And although I use a lot the computer myself, quite frequently, I learned it from Giorgio actually. I had learned about programming when I was at Ecole Normale as a student. But it was a very complicated thing because you had to write the program on a piece of paper and ask one person who was preparing the cards to fill in the machine. And then the machine would take a long time to answer you, there is a bug in the program, etc. So it was a very long process. But when I went to Rome as a postdoc, we started to have terminals, etc. And there was Giorgio, who was already quite good and had a way of thinking in terms of numerical computation. So I started redoing numerical computation at that moment, and I never ended. I always consider it as a very nice tool, but I never wanted to go into large scale numerical simulations. I think I am not enough organized in some sense. I am losing the files and the thing. So that's why for the 3D spin glass, yes, we had tried this 1 over D expansion because it made sense with respect to what we knew about the SK model to see if we can extend it through a 1 over D expansion. But I did not push that much. I did one more paper on that with Olivier Martin and Florent Zakala, etc., when I was in Orsay. That was not very much.
But so was it your idea to do this expansion, or I mean, why? I mean, it's sort of a different direction altogether from what you'd done before. Right?
No, that was a paper with Georges and Yedidia.
Yes,
Yedidia at that moment. Jonathan was visiting us. He was a PhD student of Phil Anderson, and he was spending 1 year in Paris. And so, in some sense, I was his supervisor during his stay in Paris. Let's say that was agreed like that. He didn't need any supervision because he was very independent, autonomous, etc. But so I think he came and started to discuss about doing something on the finite dimensional spin glass, and that's how we went into that. For me, it has never been a mainstream line of research, but it's not something that I consider uninteresting. If I had a bright idea that would solve a 3D spin glass, I can tell you I would stop everything else and do it right now. But this idea never materialized so far.
By the early 1990s, you largely left the field of neural networks. What drew you away from these questions?
I think I was not the only one. I think that a large fraction of the physicists who had been interested in neural networks, they stopped also at that moment. There were several ingredients. There was an ingredient that was the interaction with the biologists, in our case, in Paris, did not work well. I told you it did not materialize into anything that could become concrete. And so that was a kind of disappointment. It was a real disappointment for me in some sense. And I preferred to quit the field rather than live with this disappointment. So that was one other thing. There were tensions also between Gérard Toulouse, Jean-Pierre Changeux. So it was difficult. So I preferred to get away from all that. Neural networks for computer science did not show much performance. I mean, in retrospect, all the right ideas were there. Everything that has happened in the last 10 years, I mean, the revolution of the deep networks, I think that the theory was already present at that time. It was we had every, not only the theory, but the main steps of the algorithm, the backpropagation, etc. Everything was there. But at that time, it did not work. It did not work because we didn't have enough, big enough computers, and we didn't have the databases. Above all, databases, I think, was the big missing ingredient. So that is another thing. And then there started to be at that time also a lot of interest in, condensed matter was very busy with high-TC superconductors, etc., etc. So there were many other attractive problems back in the heart of physics that were interesting.
In 1991, you wrote a popular science piece for La Recherche, Des vers de spin au réseau de neurones, with Gérard Toulouse. How did this popular science piece come about?
Oh, I wrote several popular pieces about spin glass and neural networks.
That's probably one of the higher profile ones.
Maybe, yes. I think it is it's quite natural. By that time, it was clear that it was a topic that had made a big leap, big progress, and so there were questions about that. There were people wanted to understand it, both scientists in other disciplines, but also, as I told you, we were. I mean, at that time, I really dedicated quite some time in the second half of the 80s, quite some time in discussing with a lot of people from very different communities. I told you about linguistics, I told you about biology, computer science, engineers in computer science. People wanted to build dedicated computers with neurons inside, etc., artificial neurons inside. A lot of things like that. So I was pretty much in this interface with different communities, which had brought me to think about how to describe all this progress. How can you? It's technical, it's in some sense very technical, but still the main ideas you can convey them to a much broader public, much broader audience of colleagues in completely different disciplines who have not much mathematical background, and try to tell them what has been done. So I had this experience from my interaction with the other communities. There were some multidisciplinary commissions, the committees for fellowships of this or that. I mean, there was a full committee of the Minister of Research, French Minister of Research, about cognitive science, and they were sitting there. And so we had to review and discuss a lot of proposals that were very diverse. And so there was this, let's say, it was a time at which I learned how to discuss with other communities, scientific communities, let's say.
And I thought it was important, I still think it is, and I think it was a very interesting time actually, and I learned a lot. It was probably quite useful for my professional life later on. When I became in 2012 director of Ecole Normale, the fact of having this long experience of interacting with people from very diverse backgrounds was quite useful. So, in this context, writing some kind of I don't know if one should say popular, but at least non-technical account of what had been done in Spinglasses and neural network was very natural.
In that piece, in particular, you wrote that the analogy between spin and structural glasses was, in your words, boiteuse. Car pour décrire la structure d'un verre, les positions des atomes sont les seules variables, tandis que dans le cas du verre de spin, il existe des paramètres gelés. Had you paid much attention to the structural glass problem at that point when you wrote this?
Not as much as I should have done. I completely missed one important thing, which is the Kirkpatrick theorem à l'aïvoliness. I had missed it. And I plead guilty, but when Peter Volinus visited Paris at some point, well, I don't remember the year, he visited Ecole Normale, and he was trying to explain his ideas about the connection between replica symmetry breaking and the structural glass problem. And I did not understand him. I did not understand what he meant, what he had in mind. I just missed the point. They regret it. I think that yes, it was it's a question of, in some sense, personal fits of personalities and way of expressing himself and myself, etc. That it did not match. But had we matched at that moment, I'm sure we would have made progress much earlier, because a lot of things were there. But there was this. I mean, this very problem of the quench disorder or not was really something that, for me, it was a cognitive obstacle. That is, I really had this impression, having come into the disordered systems from the spin glass and from the replica method, etc., and from the average of a disorder. What do you do in a system which has no quench disorder? Let's say that was for me. Something that was a very big obstacle in order to accept the idea that the method that we had could be relevant for systems without quench disorder. So that's why we worked with Jean-Philippe Bouchot to try to see and understand if there could be spin glasses without disorder. Let's say what we call spin glasses without disorder. At the same time, there was a group in Rome which was doing also developing the spin glasses without disorder, let's say, with Giorgio, Enzo Marinari, and Felix Ritorta. So, these are papers, maybe they are not as well known as others, but I think that they are, for me at least, they were crucial papers. They were crucial papers because they were unlocking this thing that seemed a huge barrier between two fields that were different, one with quench disorder, the other without. Discovering, at least for us, having cooked up some models in which we understood that the disorder could be self-induced by the system, by its dynamics, let's say. I cut it a long story short, but that's more or less what we had done, that was important. And that from there on you could describe it by replicas. Then that was, for me, it was the moment that it opened the gate towards this. What year was it now? I am lost about that.
So 1994, I think, is when you I found those.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to understand this a little bit better, so I had a few questions. The first one is, when did you say that Volinus visited Paris and you had this discussion?
I don't know.
It was early 90s, late 80s?
I don't remember. I do not remember. It might be the end of the 80s.
I am not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. He must so remember. Maybe, okay. Maybe or maybe not.
We will, and so, again, to try to situate things, so when you left the field of neural networks in the, it was about 1990, then you started working for a few years on interfaces and polymers, and so you have the work on the random manifolds, the variational theory for random manifolds, and the series of works on polymers. So why you chose to work on this set of problems, and how did you?
Well, my impression is that the impression that I had was the following. On the one hand, there was a whole series of works on optimization, and this I thought that it had come to the end of a cycle. I mean, we could do much more in the same line, but we had looked at the matching aleatoric Seisman problem. We knew where were the frontiers. It was very difficult to go beyond, and I thought that it was good to leave it aside, let's say, that it had come to the end of a certain cycle, it could. And for the question of neural networks and neurobiology, I told you, and I would add to that that I have always tried in my scientific life to move to new topics relatively regularly, let's say, to not to be the person that would stay in the thing for decades. And I always thought that it was better for me, at least, maybe, it's, I don't know if it is better for science, but better for me to move into another field and come with my ideas in some slightly different fields, not too far that I can bring something. But that was always how I worked. So indeed, at the beginning of the 90s, I decided to get back to problems of physics, of condensed matter, let's say, and look at problems of disordered systems. But other problems of disordered systems, in which it was quite different, like polymers, like interfaces, the peeling of interfaces. It was all, these were also problems that were very important in condensed matter. I mean, the peeling of interfaces, it was our experimental result. There was the peeling of the vortex lattice, that was very important to understand how ITC superconductor works. There we had done the variational method with Giorgio, the variational method for random Gaussian variational method with replicas, which was a kind of versatile tool that could be applied to a lot of things, and we applied it with Jean-Philippe Bouchot and Jonathan Yedidia to vortex lattices. But we had not quite well taken into account the periodicity of the lattice in the theory that we did, and it is really Giammarchi that did it well, let's say. But so it was a whole field in itself, this peeling of interfaces. It is still a whole field. I mean, it has grown into something which has become very rich and. But yes, at that time it was clear to me that it was an interesting series of problems in which there were experiments, in which when the replica method could bring something.
And so this is the time where you started working with Jean-Philippe on these problems.
Yes, yes.
So Jean-Philippe at the time was still a PhD student at the École Normale.
No, I think he was in Seclé already.
No, 1994.
No, right.
1990, 1992.
Yes.
No, he's no longer a PhD student. He's already established.
So what was the situation at the École Normale at the time? So in the, say, 1990 to 1994, I mean, this period where you were working on these problems, you were at the École Normale, and there was... How was the group, StatFIS group, organized?
Well, we were, I would say, statistical physics had evolved into a more autonomous branch, let's say, of physics. I had my collaborators, my students, etc., etc. So, yes, it was.
it had matured with respect to what I had seen a decade and a half before, when I was myself a student there. There had been some tensions, etc., because of the, I mean, to what extent could we have new students coming who did not go through the field theory applies to particle phenomenology. Well, but at that time, the field itself of statistical physics had gotten more mature. Statistical physics of disordered system was considered a respectable activity for a theoretical physicist. So it was, yes, I think it went okay. But it has been like that in many labs. That is it, what is the size that you can give to statistical physics with respect to elementary particle, high energy, usual high energy physics? That's in École Normale, there was also the creation of a lab of statistical physics in which there would be both theorists and experimentalists. I decided to stay in my original lab, which was theoretical physics, but I could have moved there. That would have been possible.
So this was also the time when many students like Jean-Philippe, Antoine Georges started to directly into statphys, right?
Yes, yes, that was why that created a little bit of tension, that some of the advisors of the old school were considering, like even Claude Bouchia would consider that this was not, that one should still train the people to do not necessarily standard, but high energy physics, and then they would go to statistical physics. Mm-hmm. While the young students that you mentioned, Antoine, Jean-Philippe, Pierre Le Doussal, etc., wanted to go right away, and they considered that there was plenty of other things to learn in condensed matter physics, that you have a lot of experimental things to learn, etc., and that maybe it's not necessary to learn supersymmetry, but you can do other things, let's say.
So, and then we arrived to 1994, and I think I come back to the same question I asked before, because this is something that kind of bugs me a little bit. I don't understand how things went from the work you did in 84-85 on the what we call now the random first order transition in the P-spin and the REM, then to Kirkpatrick, Tirumalai and Volnes, who did all this series of works between 87-89, and then it seems like it stayed in the US during this time, from 87-89, and then you start to see back in Europe this activity on finding models without disorder that could be in this university class, and so there is the activity you mentioned of Marinari, Ritort, and Parisi. So in Rome, people started to look for models that could be models without disorder that could be.
Yes, we did. It was simultaneously with Jean-Philippe in Paris. Yes.
How the ideas
at least
circulated between.
For me, it was not. I mean, the motivation was trying to see if really this fundamental barrier between quench disorder and no quench disorder that had been an obstacle to even my capacity of approaching the problem of the structural glasses, to see if it was a strong barrier or not, could we erase it in some sense. But it was not motivated by the works of Kirkpatrick, Tirumalai and Volnes.
Because what is, I did a little bit of research looking at the papers, and I found that most papers from that time, I mean 1994, say, cite the work of Kirkpatrick, Tirumalai and Volnes, so people knew it, but often it is cited for technical things, like there is a reference, I don't know, for this technical calculation, look at, but not for the idea of connecting the two words, I mean, the word of quench disorder.
No,
so people had not digested it, or it was not.
At least I told you, I had not digested it myself.
But it seems you were not the only
one. And I think I'm not the only one. It was formulated in such a way, I don't want. I'm not blaming anything, but it's an interesting case of a development that took a few years to be acceptable. And And it's related to the way of thinking to the problem, the way of writing, of explaining it. And of these fundamental obstacle of the Quench disorder, which I insist, to me at least, it was something that was very important. Because when you have such an objection, you know, from the very first line, you have these thick papers, technical, etc., which use replicas, and you say, but what are these replicas doing here? What are you average upon? There is no disorder, guys. So it's a kind of big obstacle. So until, at least for me, until we had the two series of work, that, I mean the work that we did with Jean-Philippe and the work of Marina Riparisi-Ritort, these were separated worlds.
So the crucial, the moment where it became acceptable for you, and I think also for the community in Europe at large, was after these two works?
For me, certainly. I would not say anything about the community at large. But that does not mean that that the work by Thiro Malai, Kirkpatrick and Volines, I understood completely at that time, but certainly this fundamental objection was erased at that moment, and so it became possible to go back to that.
So, throughout, I mean, after leaving Rome from 86 up until, you know, even 15 years later, you kept on collaborating with Giorgio on projects. How was this collaboration maintained? How would you two would be typically working with each other?
I mean, I have been visiting Rome from time to time. He was visiting Paris from time to time. We had mails, etc. I mean, it was very easy. I mean, with Giorgio, after all these many collaborations, we understand each other very easily. I mean, there are people who said that Giorgio is difficult to understand. To me, he's crystal clear. So I have this chance. That's a wonderful chance in life. So. So, no, I think it was always going very, very easily. There is one moment in which we really had to meet for a longer time and discuss on a day-to-day basis for several weeks. That's a bit later. That's when we went to the finite connectivity spin glasses, let's say, solving the system with finite connectivity. That was a very hard thing to do. And so this we met, I remember we spent 1 month in Trieste working together really every day and in the park and in the office and everywhere.
But maybe before we get to that next step, I mean, after these papers of 1994, I mean, yours with Jean-Philippe and the one of Marinari, Parisi and Ritort, there was an explosion of works on structural glasses for a few years. So there was your work with Giorgio on the HNC, there was all the work of Giorgio with Silvio on the Franz Parisi potential and the application to glasses, and there was the work of Culiandolo and Kurchan on the aging. So can you describe a little bit to us how the community functioned at the time? I mean, there was this explosion of work, so how was it organized? There were networks, there were conferences, there were... How the communication between, let's say, the Rome and the Paris groups that were very active on this subject was...
No, but I mean, by those years, we had a lot of collaboration between the Rome and Paris groups. We had exchanged students, postdocs, etc. I mean, quite a lot of our students had come to Rome and reciprocally. So we had many, many, many possible contacts. Now in the list of work that you mentioned, I would not have put them together. I would have said that there are two directions. One is the direction of the dynamics, and the other is the direction of structural glasses. That's not exactly the same thing. Although they get some connection at some point through mode coupling and things like that, of course. Mm-hmm. But Culiandolo Kurchan originally is is a study of the dynamics of spin glasses,
let's say,
with their Quetsch disorder, etc., and with the tools of the P-spin model, all the tools that we know, let's say, about the P-spin model, and you relate it to the landscape of the P-spin model, etc. So that was a very interesting work. As soon as it appeared, their first work, which wasn't the P-spin, it was with one. I mean, what was really nice in their work is that, with respect to what Sompolinski and Zipelius had done in 1981, they proposed something which was a kind of reinterpretation, in which instead of having the time that diverges, let's say, you could have, I mean, it was the idea of the aging. It was the idea that you have to look at the ratio between the time of the experiment and the time of the aging. And it was a kind of a reinterpretation of the equations that are familiar, but that were all of a sudden acquiring something completely different. So immediately when I saw that, I was very interested in that. In fact, we did with Silvio the generalization to more general ultrametric, more general hierarchy of several steps of replica symmetry breaking, and they did it, of course, at the same time, etc. But I immediately considered that it was something very interesting. Then the main issue of that was that it gave also a tool to connect to the finite dimensional spin glass, because you could do the mapping, let's say, that we did later with Giorgio, Silvio, Pelliti also was there.
But I think the reason why the two things are connected in my mind, and I might be wrong, is that I always had the impression that one of the big successes of the work of Cugliandro and Kurchan in 1993 is that the aging of the P-spin that they described there is very similar to the aging of structural glasses, much more than the aging of spin glasses, right? Because you have the two steps.
Because you have the alpha and beta relaxation.
The alpha and beta. And
yes.
So that's why I thought that this led to a,
yes, that
to
is
a,
true.
To a connection. And I mean, I think in your paper altogether, I mean, the Bouchot, Mesar, Cugliandro, Kurchan, I think you described that and you make the connection.
Yes, the review, in some sense, this is a review paper that wants to connect all these pieces together.
And
so you are right.
96,
this
so
is
still
yes.
part
yes,
of
it
that
is
explosion.
Part, you are, yes, you are right. It is part of this explosion. But in some sense, for me, now I came to that with two different directions. One mm-hmm. about studying the out-of-equilibrium dynamics in spin glasses, P-spins, etc. And the other one, which is trying to work on structural glasses from first principles, in spite of the fact that they have no Quetsch disorder, let's say. So, but of course it converges, you're right. It converges to the kind of a scheme that through the connection with the mode coupling and the alpha beta relaxation, it becomes close to each other, yes.
And so on the HNC work, on the liquid theory work, how did it happen? I mean, how did you have the idea? How did you learn about liquid state theory? And
well, at some point, so there starts to be this idea that you can use replicas in a system without disorder because it allows you to compute the complexity, let's say. And so, well, it was natural for us with Giorgio to try to understand if it applies to liquids. And so, of course, we studied a little bit the standard theory of liquids, let's say, which is what it is. And but one thing that for me was important in all these things, well, in retrospect it looks simple, but at least for me it was a surprise, was this idea that when you look at a liquid with replicas, that the glass state will be characterized by a kind of effective molecules in which you have replicas of each color bound together. And this idea of the bound state of a molecular liquid with clones or whatever you want to call them is an idea that, well, now maybe there is, I don't know if there is a fundamental difference with what we knew from spin glasses, but to me at least there was. And in fact, I often also used it to try to characterize, even for a wider, a broader public, a broader or larger audience, to try to tell them what is a glass state. Well, how you decide that there is a glass state. Well, you know, you put this system, they attract each other, and if you release this attraction, will they remain correlated or not, let's say. And that translates itself into this molecular description of the liquid. This, I think, was a nice idea. I think it's a cute idea. And to me, at least, to build it, it involved quite a lot of steps with respect to what I knew about spins and the thing that I knew very well about states in 1RSB systems. That was, so there was, in some sense, there were two things. One is the quench disorder. Okay, you can apply it if you count states in a system which does not have quench disorder. That's good. And the second one was, well, if you really want to use it for atoms, interacting atoms or molecules, then you have to describe it with these effective colored molecules, let's say. And this was a cute idea that took some time to mature.
And so again, so throughout the time, I mean, the decade from 1992, 93 to 2000, you didn't have any discussion or interaction with Kirkpatrick's Thermalian Balance, because in the meanwhile they had kind of left, they had moved to other problems, so there was no overlap.
No overlap.
Okay.
In a review you wrote in 2000, you mentioned of the work on glasses, right? You mentioned there was still a lot of work to do, say on the analytical side, some better approximations of the molecular liquid state, allowing to go beyond the small cage expansion, for instance. But you nevertheless left the field. What, again, in this context, what drew you away?
Well, there is my recurrent motor, which is to not stay in a field for too long, because, I don't know, at some point I get... And simultaneously to that, there was the big curiosity and a big move about real contact with computer science through the finite connectivity models. That was very exciting. And I could not keep a good activity on the glasses together with the development of this new field in computer science. I mean, I had to choose, and I choose a new one, as I kind of always do. Maybe I should have stayed there, because but that's how it goes.
So to get on, I mean, is there something else you wanted to ask about? No. So to get about the finite connectivity work, you mentioned that you had worked with Giorgio. So how do you recall this came about, this new direction?
No, but this direction we had, I mean, I think that as soon as, what was it, 1987 or something like that, we had written a paper with Giorgio on finite connectivity spin glass, in which, I don't remember exactly what we did, but we did what would be the replica symmetric case, let's say, and we said it would be so nice to do replica symmetry breaking for this problem. And we didn't know how to do it. So it's a problem that was in our mind. Problem that was in our mind for more than 10 years. And at some point we saw, how to handle that, and but it was a very difficult work. I think it was a complicated thing. Conceptually, it's probably one of the hardest things that I had to, that we had to work upon. I mean, the paper on the beta lattice spin glass, it's a difficult paper if you read it really correctly. And I remember that because even when I was giving talks about it, it was not easy. It was not easy. People had hard time understanding it, and even for us, it was not so easy to formulate it. Then, after a few years,
thanks to the exportation of these ideas to optimization problems and the mapping to belief propagation, etc., it became much, much more accessible, and we could transform it into something that that is much easier. But at the beginning, it was really, really complicated, because always because of this same problem that you have, the interplay of the cavity with the displacement of the free energies, let's say, that how the reorganization of the free energies. And it's a much more subtle version with respect to this game.
So when you started working on this, why did you think that this was the right time, or what was the new insight that you had that made it possible to attack RSB then on a finite connectivity graph?
I'm not sure there was one. I look at the papers of that time, but I do not think. No, I think I would not be able to say that. As I said, this was in our mind. This we knew, that it was a challenging, difficult problem, one of these problems that, you know, you say someone has to come up with a solution to that, because And we knew that in parallel in computer science, Zekina, Monasson, etc., had been, and there was of course the numerical work by Kirkpatrick and Selman, etc., who had started to work on satisfiability, and Giulio Biroli, they had done also a variational approach. So we knew that there was this system also there. But yes, that was something that needed to be done.
And it was then. So was the time to attack this problem was because of this work that you had seen by Kirkpatrick and collaborators, or
no, I don't think so.
So what set the timing then for?
I do not remember. I don't know. A conversation with Giorgio. I don't remember where it took place. yes, I don't know. Maybe a small influence. We had a paper when I was in Santa Barbara. We had been working. I had been working also with Giorgio in Santa Barbara on structural relapses, etc. But also we had done this paper with Tony Z and Euclidean random matrices which are built from distances between points in a d-dimensional space, let's say. And maybe that was giving some, at least that was a problem in which you had to think about finite connectivity things, but technically what we did was very, very different.
So once you built that machinery, however, you quickly went on to random satisfiability problems. How did you get, you know, had you been paying attention to these problems throughout?
Not really, but Riccardo Zecchina came as a visitor. What year was it? Was I at Ecole Normale, or I don't remember what year it was, but you know, we were in Orsay.
Okay.
I was in Orsay at that moment. I had moved to Orsay, I think. Well, no, I was about to move to Orsay. I think it was still in the Colonel. Never mind, doesn't matter. Riccardo came for a few months, and he arrived, and then we started to discuss, and it was a natural sense of this discussion to say, well, there is, on one hand, he had been working on the satisfiability. We had this new way of approaching diluted systems with Giorgio, so it was a natural thing to work on that together, and that was very natural. And I remember that, so that must be the winter of 2001. Christmas of 2001 when I went to vacation, and they worked like crazy during my vacation time because I was so excited about this problem. And basically writing the cavity equation for the KSAT and for the XORSAT problem, because I did the two simultaneously, because one helped me to check the other, let's say. Mm-hmm. And they came back, and I should apologize to my family for those 15 days of vacation, but you know, that's science is like that. And I came back, and we discussed with Ricardo, and we start to look and work the equations together and so on. And then at some point, we are in front of the computer, putting the equation on the computer, and he says, but these equations that we are writing, they look like equations we could write on a given graph. And we said, okay, let us try. And then we start to write the equations on a given graph. And so it comes with an algorithm, with SP, etc., etc. So that was a very exciting time.
So your former student, Rémy Monasson, had worked on these problems, but you had not paid attention to that work at that point.
Not really.
Okay. What was the initial reaction of the theoretical computer science community to this new approach? Was it in any way different than their reaction in the 80s when you had worked on the traveling salesman's problem?
It was completely different for several reasons. I would think that probably on the one hand, on the theoretical side, we and our methods had acquired a certain respectability, let's say, in the sense that we had given a solution to the random link matching problem, things like that, let's say. So that was one thing. But above all, the positive reaction, or at least the reaction, came from practitioners of the satisfiability problem. There is a whole community of people who do SAT solvers, etc., who are professionals of that. And for them, it was this when we proposed the survey propagation for the random 3-SAT, it was a completely different way of addressing the problem than what they were doing before. They were not even using BP or whatever, but not to say SP. And it was surprising to them that it was possible at all to work with samples of 100,000 variables so close to the critical point, let's say, and solve them. That was a big surprise. And I remember that when we made the code public, there were some colleagues using it, etc. And then they would send a mail to Ricardo or to me saying, well, it doesn't work, I tried it, but it doesn't work. And I answered, but you tried it on what size? I'd say, 200. And we say, try 20,000. And 20,000, it worked. Because it's an asymptotic algorithm. It's an algorithm that is based on what happens at very large n. So paradoxically, it might non-converge at small sizes. And so it meant an enormous gap for a problem which is exponential. I mean, they used to run the algorithm at 200, and we are saying, look, completely different. So this, yes, I think this created a traction. I think that another point that was interesting was created before we joined the subject, let's say. It was clear. Before we joined the subject, it was clear that there was very probably a critical point. There was no proof of that, but the numerics was finite size scaling was pointing at a critical point. And there was a Friedgood theorem that told you that the threshold becomes sharp, so it had not been established that it has a limit, but still, there was a critical point. And so that was for us, it was a phase transition point, so it was clearly an interesting phase transition computer science. And for them, in particular people who are interested in complexity theory and also practitioners, it is a factory of hard instances. I mean, the hard instances of random satisfiability, they are close to the critical point. It's not that surprising in retrospect, but it is there. So the whole community were interested in that
problem, let's say, a random satisfiability problem close to its critical point, with various motivations, but at least there was a... And this, in my experience, is something that makes interdisciplinary contacts much easier. When you happen to have people of various community which all consider that this is an important point, an important regime, an important, that is much easier. And it is in this context that we made the prediction on the critical point and above all the existence of the intermediate glass phase, which had been hinted at by the variational approach that was done before by Miroli, Manasson, and Weigt, I think, yes. But that was established by our solution, let's say. So that has attracted interest.
So were you aware of the timeliness of the questions when you worked this, or it's just good luck, right? That did you know that the computer scientists were going to be receiving these ideas favorably, or you found out that
it was difficult to know if someone will receive your ideas favorably, but at least, well, it was clear when we discussed that when Ricardo arrived in Paris and we started to discussing it, it was very clear to him he had been working on that. Mm-hmm. So and then I mean, reading the papers by Selman, by Kirkpatrick, by all these numerical papers, it was quite clear that there was some excitement around that. That was no doubt.
And by any chance, your experience working in the interdisciplinary fields for a decade and a half at that point, and writing popular science pieces explaining your ideas, did that play any role, do you think, in being able to communicate these ideas to the new community, or it remained fairly technical?
Most of it remained fairly technical, but I think that on some occasion there was a possibility to try to address a broader audience and communicate what there was in the Spinglass theory that could be useful. And this, yes, I had accumulated experience in doing that, of course. So, my first answer would have been no, but my second answer would probably yes, it has been helpful, because I mean, several things have been helpful. The fact that by that time, maturity about explaining what is replicas, what is all this about, let's say, what is replica symmetry breaking about, this helps because you have to explain it to people who are completely outside of the field. And then it happened to arrive also at a moment where, but also the maturity of what we had been doing was much better recognized. I mean, people in 2000, there was a wide acceptance that replica symmetry breaking was a very important method that had solved a number of problems. So it was easier to present it to.
But it was still before the Telegram results, so it was not as if it had been formally accepted by more rigorous.
Sure, sure, sure. It was still a mathematical problem, but I would say that before its rigorous solution, there was a long moment, a long duration during which it was well accepted by a lot of people, except for the question of its relevance to 3D Spinglass, let's say. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, as a general method of disordered systems in theoretical physics, it was very well accepted, even if it was not proven rigorously.
Since that work, you have largely left, I would say, the more materials physics community. Is that your view or your understanding of it before I...
Yes, well, there has been, for me, there was... it's not totally true, first of all. I see, I'm checking in the in the list, but yes, I was working on random heteropolymers, on other disordered systems, etc. So, but it is true that I was gradually moving towards problem of computer science and information theory. Because the message passing, that was basically, let's say, the simplest version of the cavity method for diluted system, the replica symmetric one, is easy, and it is connected to belief propagation, which is a very well-known message passing algorithm that is used in other disciplines, in information theory, Bayesian analysis, etc., etc. So this was a very big link between other fields, and it prompted me to move towards these other fields. So yes, I think it was natural. And then probably, well, the moment in which I really had to make a hard choice was 2012, when I became director at Ecole Normale, because at that moment I knew that I could not continue having simultaneously a work on heteropolymers, a work on problem information theory, and a work on optimization problems, let's say. So I had to choose. And then I focused really on inference and information theory. But before that, I tried to maintain, let's say, an activity diverse. But yes, gradually moving towards what you could say computer science at large. But information theory, modern information theory, I would gladly incorporate it as a branch of statistical physics. I have no problem with that.
So throughout these years, did you nevertheless follow the evolution of the statistical physics, say, of structural glasses after you left and worked at Bouchot and Biroli and then others? Did you not pay much attention to it because of?
No, I paid attention, but a bit from far, because I could not find the time to study the papers in all details. But of course, no. But and then there were some things that were also quite connected to things that were very important in what we did on information theory and random graph, like point to set correlations, which is absolutely crucial for the cavity method used to study finite connectivity constraint satisfaction problem. And so this I studied in quite detail, and also, yes, the four-point correlations, I mean, all this I followed, let's say, but I could not find the time to get back active into this.
From, we're approaching the end of our questions, and it's an extended end, but nevertheless, from your standpoint, what do you feel has allowed the ideas of replica symmetry breaking to thrive in some circles and not so much in others? What might have impeded its reception in some contexts?
Well, I think maybe replica symmetry breaking is a tool. It is a tool of theoretical physics, a beautiful tool that opens a lot of possibilities, but it is a tool. And it is not, at least initially, it was not obviously related to a material. It was related to spin glasses, of course, and we saw the initial success with the two field cooled and zero field cooled magnetization, then decouple, etc. So it has some impact, but in the usual sense of a physical theory, it is still a bit remote from the material itself. It is difficult to to translate it into a quantitative prediction, saying you will measure this and you will find that, let's say. So that is complicated. And it is furthermore complicated by the fact that it addresses problems in which the order parameters correspond to local alignment. And so most of the experimental checks that you would think of would need the ability to measure local structures in many places in your system. So they are necessarily very complicated from the experimental point of view. So that might have been an obstacle to the popularization of the method in the physics circles, let's say. One might argue that it has been more popular, more accepted in countries in which there is more a tradition of, let's say, theoretical physics built from the theory, let's say, in some sense, in a rationalist attitude. So it's probably not by case that the people who have constructed it came from field theory, came from this culture of the theoretical physics, of an abstract theoretical physics. Giorgio himself is very much grown in that culture of the field theory, that's very clear. Miguel, myself, etc., we are all, David and Ross, all coming from this thing here. And maybe it was harder to get accepted by communities which have more a point of view which is more empirical, more based directly on data and the direct connection with the data. So I think this is one obstacle. On top of this, there was the debate about applicability or not of RSB to 3D Spinglass, which certainly blocked quite some evolution and reinforces this dichotomy that I was saying before between, let's say, the theory towards experiment versus the experiment towards theory approach. And in some sense, some of the big successes that we have seen are in fields which are not really material science. They are fields in which you are studying devices, algorithms, etc., which you have built. If you are in information theory and you want to create an error correcting code for communication, you build your code. And you build your code and you don't necessarily have the constraints of the three-dimensional space. Let's say you may have at the end when you implement it, but at least you have more freedom. So I would not see it myself as a fundamental difference. Let's say a lot of the condensed matter physics is elaborated for many decades now on systems that we build. They are artifacts, human-made artifacts. I mean, you don't find a quantum Hall effect device in nature. You have to build it. So the same way that you have to build an error correcting code, etc. So, but still, I think that this has been probably an obstacle towards material science adoption of these systems. But this has erased gradually, and I think it is becoming more and more accepted. The thing that I found also beautiful is that it has opened the space to so many developments in math and in so many other branches. And also one should emphasize, probably we have not emphasized enough, that it took quite some time to confirm the validity of all this. I mean, before we had Guerra, Talagrand, etc. I mean, the whole mathematicians coming into play. And I remember when there was the first confirmation by Talagrand, but before there was a confirmation of ultrametricity, I remember we had a discussion with Giorgio, and we were discussing between ourselves and saying, well, but ultrametricity is delicate. Maybe they will not confirm ultrametricity. I mean, we thought that ultrametricity is correct, certainly, roughly speaking, let's say, but that it be exactly correct is something else, because in some sense, you start to play with something which is very delicate there, which is your free energy differences of order one, etc. So you see, it might be that you have the gross structure is correct for density of free energies, but it's no longer correct when you go to... So we were still wondering whether it would be confirmed. And a lot of the results that were elaborated over the years, it took long time to confirm them, or in fact. I remember we were discussing when we did the use of RSB methods for neural networks. Sorry. With Werner Kraut, we did this work, which was the capacity of memory of a binary perceptron. Very simple work. It was extending the thing. It was well known for continuous perceptron that the critical threshold was 2, the ratio of the number of patterns to neurons. But for binary perceptron, it was not at all clear, and we had put forward this conjecture, I would say educated conjecture, let's say, because we said there is a hidden, very subtle 1RSB structure that shows that it should be the zero entropy solution of the RS will give you the result, and this 0.83. I remember when we did that with Werner Kraut, Bernard Derrida, for instance, thought that it was not correct. And he worked on proving that it was not correct for a few months, even together with Griffiths, I remember, they were working together. So at that time I was worried, I said, wow. But, I mean, we had done all the possible checks that we had in our hands, but it was still not completely sure. So I think this is another aspect that was, I mean, by the way, this conjecture is not yet completely confirmed. I mean, there are pieces of it which are confirmed, but the threshold, the capacity of the binary perceptron, it is still not yet confirmed. It's a conjecture that goes back to 89 or something like that. So it means that there are subtle aspects, technical, behind all that, and that they can blur a little bit the acceptability of the thing. But now I do not see. I mean, I think it's much better accepted. And the thing that is very nice, I always said with the replicas, is on the one hand, it's a very compact encoding of a lot of physical properties that we know. And that is very important, so we can map the physical reality with what is encoded in the replicas. And on the other hand, you cannot cheat. In the replicas, they are there, they give you something, you cannot just, you know, turn it around. No, you have a scheme, it gives you something, it has always been confirmed. And now, in a lot of systems, it has been rigorously confirmed, because there has been, of course, a confirmation for the SK model, but also the confirmation for the constraint satisfied beautiful work by Zhao Glan, Sly, Nike Sassoon, etc.
During your time at the ENS, at Orsay, or elsewhere, did you ever teach about replica symmetry breaking or spin glasses?
In summer schools. I taught that at summer schools, mostly. Various summer schools. I went quite a few times in Les Ouches, in Targès, in Begrue. That was where I was teaching it. And then we had a course at a doctoral school of Economal in that was with Andrea Montanari, in which we taught the contact between the theory and the information theory and optimization. And that was on this course that we elaborated, that we constructed the book that we have written on that.
Information physics and computation. Yes.
Thank you for reminding me the type.
So when would that have been? And was this only once, or was this a repeated course?
No, and we taught it once. He taught it once, and then we wrote the book. But the book took us quite a few years. So I don't remember when the book was published. Was it
2009? It was published
2009. So probably we would have taught the course in 2005, 2006. Because I remember that we worked for at least 3 years to write the book. It was a lot of work.
Yes. In
we were talking about the exact results.
From my understanding, in the 90s, you met with Michel Talleyrand to try to explain to him the physics of spin glasses. How did these interactions go, and how were you involved in a way in trying to formalize RSB descriptions?
No, it was not in. Talleyrand got interested in spin glasses, and he wanted to solve this problem. And I think it is fair to say that he knew nothing about spin glasses. Actually, he knew nothing about statistical physics at all. And so I remember he contacted me and he told me, well, we have a few meetings so that I will ask you some questions and you will guide me. And that's what we did. So we had not so many, but a few meetings like that. And I would do it also to have lunch together and we discuss and he would ask questions. And the first meeting, they were really kind of elementary questions of statistical physics because he had to learn about it. And then they became more and more elaborate and subtle questions about spin glasses. And I tried to answer as far as I could. But I was impressed by his attitude. I mean, if you think about it, what it represents, in that theory, is a certain amount of work, and he dedicated several years of his life to learning that and to solving it. And he arrived in the field by saying, I want to solve that problem. And he did it. And that's quite remarkable, I think. But I was involved in helping him to get into understanding the field. But the solution is his.
So in a few contexts, you've mentioned the importance of international collaborations in the development of the field. For instance, in your popular science piece, in La Recherche, you mentioned there's a collaboration, I think it was entitled Brain or something. How important were these in your perspectives in building a community between Paris and Rome?
Well, that was crucial. I mean, that was what the fact of building a community like that was. It was a support that allowed us to have the right exchange of students, exchange of, I mean, also some faculties that came from one place to the other, students of postdocs. So it has been very important to have these tools and these European collaborations. Initially, I think Sherrington was probably among the first ones who created this the first European networks around these topics. I was the head scientist in charge of running two of these big collaborations with 12 or 13 labs in Europe, each for, I don't remember, 5 years or something like that. These were quite important, especially when I described to you the type of collaboration that we had in the 1980s when I was in Rome, and between the structure that existed then and the one that exists now, it is a completely different world. I mean, go to any of these labs and there are tens of people who work on these systems in general. So this has developed thanks to these networks, fellowships. I mean, anything that could support interaction, organize conferences, exchange students, etc. That's been very important, and I recognized it, and I dedicated a little bit of my time to managing these European networks.
You've also
mentioned a few times the your role as an academic leader, right, that you've played. Throughout these years where you were president, but you had other leadership positions, I think, before as well. Did you have ever the opportunity to tilt the scale a bit in favor of statistical physics and the study of disordered systems, or never did that take place?
Well, I try to remain very balanced and appreciate also the what is done in other fields, of course. But I mean, certainly in the choice, my point of view, first of all, is that people in charge of the big scientific institutions have to be careful to try to have active scientists who are in charge of these things. That is, not professional administrators or not scientists who have become professional administrators because they are not. And that is, I think, very important. It's probably one of the many reasons that that made me accept to become director at École Normale. But then, of course, so why is it important? It's important because as a researcher, you have certain spectrum of research that you see and that you kind of feel is important. But certainly, if I think of what I was doing at École Normale, in recent years, we created a center for quantitative biology. It is not a spin glass on RSB, but it is certainly, at least my interest towards quantitative biology certainly comes from all these interactions that started in the 1980s with the biologists about neurobiology, about neural networks, how to model them, et cetera, et cetera. And that is still going on. So that is one direct consequence of it, if you want. I would say the same thing for the Center for Data Science. But I mean, not the only one. Many people have created centers for data science. So I think it is, yes, there is an impact that one can see. Now that's an impact at large. If you think about replica symmetry baking as really the physics of disordered systems and its interfacing. What is remarkable in the RSB is how many interfaces it has generated. I mean, when I give talks about that, I think in terms of number of scientific communities of various fields, let's say math, information theory, biology, it's very broad. You cannot even list all of them in a seminar. And if you would like to list all the subtopics, you would take the whole talk discussing that. So it is, I mean, the famous sentence by Phil Anderson, it's a cornucopia. That is certainly true. I mean, and that is very nice, very important. And I think that for me, it has been very useful because it means that when I arrived at the head of École Normale, I had contacts and to some extent, moderate extent, but contacts, but also to some extent, some vision on what various subfields, but not all of them. In science, I had a good idea of what they do in cognitive science, or what they do in biology, what they do in certain fields of mathematics, certainly in probabilities. Yes, so it helps. It helps to have a broader vision.
Is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed?
Oof. Well, probably, yes. I think one chapter on which we have been a bit short, where we have passed a bit rapidly, is probably the neural network studies in the period of the end of the 80s. I think it was a very productive time with a lot of new ideas. There was the idea of Gardner, of the statistical physics in the space of networks. I think all these ideas, they have not yet maybe found their
ultimate impact. But I think that they are very, very, very interesting ideas. And there was this idea of creating a neural network, not just studying one that you have decided with a number of layers, but building them tile by tile, as we said, with Jean-Pierre Nadal, for instance. I think there were quite a few very interesting ideas. These ideas of the landscapes of neural networks, how to study the landscape and how our tools can be used to study the landscape. I think they are, yes, we could have said more. That's it.
Finally, do you still have notes, papers, correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I'm very bad with archive things. So the answer is probably no. I think I don't have much. I'm pretty sure I have nothing. I could look around, but I have not been very good in these things here. I should.
Like the two versions of the same paper that you want to get.
Forget it. No, it is certainly not.
It would be nice to see.
Certainly, but no, unfortunately. Yeah. No, I need to. I might keep some things for a few years, but regularly, when the things are published, they are published. And I consider the published version is the one that should be the reference. No, unfortunately not. Sorry.
Thank you, Mark.